We are very fortunate to live in a place that is richly blessed by art. Now, I'm not just speaking about the congregation and the artists and musicians in our midst, but the greater metropolitan area of Washington, D.C. has so many museums and different creative types of folks. We are all blessed by it. But at its best, art touches our hearts and our minds in ways that words often fail to do. The visions we read in Revelation are meant to inspire, to light up our imaginations, to cast a vision of the world for which we hunger and thirst, for which we long. But because great art often suffers from overanalysis, let us first stoke the fires of our imaginations. I didn't know Harry was going to invite you to close your eyes, but I'll ask you again to close your eyes. But instead, this time, instead of listening to the words from John's Revelation, I would invite you to imagine the most beautiful city you can, the city that you would imagine being the most beautiful and ideal to you. Please close your eyes and just imagine it. If you were floating over the city in a hot air balloon without the fear of heights, what would it look like? What are the first things you would see? What colors, shapes, smells, tastes? Now imagine your balloon landing. What does the city look like from the ground level? Where do people live and work? Where do people relax and play? How are people clothed? Remember, we're still in church. And where are you drawn in this image? Now, if you like, you can open your eyes. I'm going to pass the microphone around because I would like for you to share, as you feel led, anything about your vision. What's your ideal city look like that you feel comfortable sharing? Raise your hand, I'll bring the mic.
First thing that popped in my head was harmony with nature. Just greenery and just not in conflict.
People would ride bicycles everywhere they go.
And it would be safe to do so, right? Yeah. On dedicated lanes, right? What was your city like? Who else?
My city was pretty much made of chocolate in like Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Okay. That's fair game. I mean, it's part of the exercise, right? What else?
I pictured the cherry blossoms around the Jefferson Memorial.
I was in Spain, and cobblestone streets and roof tiles that are orange, and flowers everywhere. The bougainvillea, especially, were in full bloom.
I would envision that seeing everybody smiling and being happy and just having a great time. Yeah.
The beauty of the mountains. Mm-hmm. Flowers everywhere, clean buildings, people walking,
street vendors selling hot dogs and other niceties.
Hot dogs, chocolate, right?
Everything was pink.
Mine was like a water park.
I was thinking of an image that I've seen quite a few times, which is the old city of Jerusalem. If you go up the Mount of Olives, when the sun is coming up from the Jordan River that way, the light catches the Dome of the Rock. And ironically, it's a Muslim mosque. But it's a very beautiful sight, and it's gold-plated, so the light catches it, and it's just a very intense light that shines all over the old city of Jerusalem.
Maybe it's because I'm a Pisces. I imagine water everywhere, like canals and pools and places to sail. Other images? Well, I imagine some of those are things that you've seen, and some are things that are likely to remain parts of dreams, whole cities of chocolate. I don't know. I mean, I suppose it's possible. I guess it would just take a lot of money. Well, when we begin with the book of Genesis, creation begins almost as a dream. It's beautiful. It is good. People are created to reflect the very image of the divine, we learn. And we learn that people begin in a garden, a beautiful garden, with everything that they need. But being people, those in the garden want more. They break the rules. They're kicked out of Eden. They must toil simply to survive. And so humans grow violent and selfish. Later in Genesis, we learn about how people's appetites are growing. They want to become themselves like the gods. Our lesson for today, near the end of the last book in our canon, our scripture, is the bookend to Genesis. If Genesis is the beginning, Revelation represents the end or the fulfillment. It offers a rare glimpse of how an early Christian looked toward and hoped for the future. I was struck the first time I read this as an adult by one thing in particular. We learn in this city, now none of you described in your visions of cities great churches, right? Great temples. Well, the same thing happens in Revelation. There's not a temple to be found in the most holy city of all holy cities. Not a church. Where's religion? It's like John Lennon took over, and we're just imagining a world, right? Free of all of these divisive religions. Not a church to be found. Now, for millennia, the religious leadership of the Hebrew people had considered that the temple was the only way in which people could truly connect with Yahweh. Yahweh resided in heaven. Yahweh's presence came close to earth at specific times and specific places, but chiefly at the temple. Yahweh's presence was so powerfully otherworldly that humans couldn't even survive if they ended up seeing God's face. God's presence was so dangerous and powerful, you shouldn't even invoke God's name. How astounding, then, the vision that God, not just God's Son, but God was now going to dwell on earth among mortals. In fact, God will become the dwelling place for humans. There won't even be lights in this city. The city itself will shine bright with the divine presence. The streets, the dwellings, even the people will shine with divine glory. And this won't be the kind of horrible light that disorients, blinds, or even kills people. Humans will behold God face to face. This is not just an image of intimacy. It's a vision of union. God and humans become one. Now, the vision of the New Jerusalem is truly exceptional, but it isn't just a vision of the glorious union of Yahweh and Yahweh's chosen people. It's more radical than that. It's also a vision of healing and peace among all people. Jerusalem's light, the New Jerusalem's light, will guide the walking of all the nations. Humans from every tribe and nation will stream into the gates of the New Jerusalem. In fact, all of creation will be at such peace that the gates of the city will never be closed. That's peace. Borders, fences, no talk about that in Revelation. When people enter the city, they discover at its heart the river of the water of life flowing from the throne of God. Now, prior to this in Revelation, rivers revealed to John have been obstacles. They've been filled with signs of suffering and death. Now, the river in the New Jerusalem brings life. And spanning the river, again, we have this bookend image coming from the Garden of Eden, is the tree of life. The tree that had been at the center of Eden now, again, is at the center of the New Jerusalem. Paradise restored on earth. And what does this tree bear? 12 kinds of fruit. Remember, 12 is a great number. It means whole, complete, perfection. One for every one of the tribes of Israel, right? There are 12 kinds of fruit. Fruit for all people. Fruit for all seasons. And the leaves of the tree are medicine. They're meant for the healing of the nations. Now, though this city is a sparkling gem of a place, it's not all peaches and roses. One thing still is troubling. The universal hope that we hear expressed here contrasts with the language of exclusion. The only ones who will enter this city are those whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. Does that trouble any of you? I mean, maybe it's because I'm a universalist, maybe it's because I'm liberal. I don't know. I like to think we're all going to be together in this city. What does it mean here that it's only the people whose names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life? Now, we could go into a whole rabbit hole talking about the Book of Life and talking about 144,000 and all of these symbols and images that come out of these visions of John's work. But the fact remains that some names are not written in the Book of Life, suggests that humans can do nothing about their eternal lot, but this is not the case. The symbols and the rhetoric of Revelation are largely concerned with the beastly powers of domination which have taken hold of creation. The beasts described by John are representatives of the great empires of his day and his day's remembered history. And the author is speaking principally to those who've been persecuted, oppressed, or threatened by these powers. But some of these people are also feeling tempted by the powers. For those without wealth or status, the dangers of rejecting empire are great. These folks need hope and perseverance. To those with wealth or status, rejecting the trappings and allegiances of Babylon, right? Babylon, Rome, could mean losing it all. It was difficult to write in that day in a way that would directly challenge the empire and power of the day, right? So the language of metaphor suggests if you're faithful to Babylon, if you succumb to the temptation of orienting your life around the power and wealth and domination and corruption of Babylon, you become an abomination. You cannot enter the city which is the vision and fulfillment of eternal hope, of everlasting life. Those who would reject Babylon or Rome, for them it could mean losing all of their wealth and status, maybe even their lives. But John of Patmos persists, the author persists, the gospel of Jesus Christ isn't actually about loss. It's about sacrificing what is fleeting for what is everlasting. The wealth and power and peace of empire will not last. So John says, reject the lure of the beast and you will find yourselves included in the new age. And that brings us to this week in Reston. This last week, Kate and I got to learn some most compelling things about a place where some of you live and most of us know. Vern and his wife Vicky had us over to watch the documentary, which Vicky and their daughter Becca just directed and produced last year, right? It was just completed. Now, I guess I don't need to spend too much time tooting horns, but these guys have made some films before. In fact, they've won international awards, Peabody's, for their international documentary on Palestine. It's a very well-done movie, but it tells the most compelling story, and it begins the story of Reston with the story of its founder, Bob Simon. After World War II, as many of you know, American families were booming. That's why we call them the boomers, right? They were booming, and they needed places to live. They needed places to raise their growing families. So cities were booming, and developers started pushing out of the city boundaries to create the idealized homes and neighborhoods of the American dream, the suburbs. The automobile was making much of this possible. We could so easily drive because almost every family was able to have a car or even two cars. It changed where we were able to live and still get into work. So cities started pushing out. Vast tracts of rural landscape were bought up everywhere. Wetlands were drained, ditches and creeks covered over. Farms and pastures everywhere were becoming parking lots and zones for single-family dwellings, for picket fences and two-car garages and front yards and backyards. And there were the zones for shopping malls and office parks. And the suburban vision also created some challenges because with the size, with the scale, came sprawl, came distance, came congestion. You experience congestion around where you live? It also challenged our notion of beauty because developers found it easiest to build things alike, build every home in the neighborhood basically alike, build all the strip malls with buildings that look alike. Make sure all the fonts on the signs look alike. And so we see reflected homogeneity, but also this vision, this value of individualism. Each person, each family kind of gets their own domain, their own sort of miniature ranch. It's a different scale, but it's still reflecting this idea that the American dream is about what each of us can acquire for ourselves. And so there was less space devoted to the common areas and more space devoted to the individual detached family dwellings. Now, the movie tells the story of Robert Simon, who as a kid, you know, grew up belonging to a household of real estate developers in New York City. Because they were wealthy, they were able to travel all over the world. And so the Simon family traveled, spent a lot of time in Europe. Those of you who are describing the kind of images of the European villages, almost all of which are organized around a central plaza, right, where you get those little cobblestone streets and little cafes that kind of have seating out along the plaza and the balconies that look out into the plaza, with a lifestyle in which, those of you who've travel to Italy sometimes, or travel to other countries in Europe, are sometimes shocked by the amount of time people spend not working. It's as though that what they'd like to do with their time is sit around and sip on seltzer and just play chess with their friends or talk to their neighbors or just go to the pub. And it's like that's what life is for, enjoying it with friends or something. It's like these revolutionary values that shaped Europe somehow didn't make it to the United States because we believe in work and we believe in just keeping all of that thing going, right? So the idealized vision of the suburbs represented a challenge because we didn't have those common spaces. We also didn't have quite as much time. I don't know how many hours. It'd be interesting to do a study and see how many hours collectively we in this church spend on the road stuck in traffic. But the lifestyle, the vision of the ideal life that Robert Simon discovered when he was traveling in Europe looked so different from what he was seeing in the United States. And so when his father died, while he was, 26, 27 years old, just a young man, Robert was actually in Europe and learned of his father's passing. And then he learned that he was becoming the chief of all the family business and operations. And so because of his studies and his orientation, his interests, he decided when he got back to the States, he wanted to pursue trying to develop in a different way. So the family actually owned Carnegie Hall, and they sold it. And with the proceeds, Robert Simon went looking around the country for some space that he could afford to purchase a large tract of land, but that was also going to be in a location that would ensure that its value would continue to grow. And when he discovered the place that is now Reston, located directly between the city and its new airport, right? Even though there was no Silver Line, even though there were not even really good highways for people to commute, he knew one day it would be a very valuable, desirable location. It was also beautiful land and had creeks and forests and the ability to kind of dam some of those up and make those waterways. I don't know if he was a Pisces or not, but he liked the vision of water. And so he developed this master plan for building Reston around seven different little smaller scale villages, really. The vision was of something that looked more like Europe. And so the communities had, each community had a common area that could be a center for retail, but mostly the kind of retail, not like the big box stores or the large shopping malls, but he envisioned something that was a retail space, childcare space, places for church, for community centers, for all kinds of partaking of the arts, of entertainment, but mostly so that people could just get together and enjoy each other's presence. Sitting around on a chair drinking some seltzer or microbrews. I don't think they had microbrews then, but today in those villages you can go in Reston and find tasty microbrews and sit down with your friends and play chess and go out on the boat. Vern and Vicky have a little pontoon boat that they take out, and so they just go from their backyard on the boat over to where the cafes and restaurants are. It's a really amazing kind of vision, but it included a little bit more than that, because he knew that one of the things that was starting to trap women in a life that was less connected and more isolated was this vision of the suburbs and the large zones and the individual family dwellings. And so Bob Simon really prioritized childcare, the integration of schools, the integration of communities with folks from different income levels. And they wanted to create, in this vision, Simon wanted to create communities in which you could spend your whole life, so that when you were young, maybe a student, maybe you needed an apartment, that there would be apartments nearby that you could afford. And then as you matured, maybe developed some more income, you could afford a larger place, have a family, have a little more space, there would be those kinds of homes there too. And then as you approach retirement and decide to scale back, find a smaller place, those kinds of homes would be available too. Now I know those of you who know Reston are like, well, affordable, that's increasingly a challenge, isn't it? The beautiful way this documentary weaves together the different tension and conflict over the evolving story picks this up. Because as Reston becomes more desirable, many of those who had been able to purchase into the vision and buy homes were increasingly priced out of those homes, and their children no longer able to afford to live in the same place. And so again, this vision was challenged and threatened by the larger pattern of our society. And so I won't spoil the story or what happens, but I think the takeaway from the movie is that it takes people's ongoing effort and engagement of the vision for the dream to be realized. Because as places become more desirable, it takes that kind of commitment and insight to adapt and evolve and make sure there are still solutions. And so Reston has still gone out and sought out options to create housing for the homeless, for example, to create programs that help to subsidize the cost of some homes for lower-income families so that both the bank, the lender, and the homeowners are able to build equity together as the home values increase. And so that has given a step up for a lot of people. Now, I'm not here to idealize Reston. I mean, it's a beautiful place, and I'm jealous of some of you who live there and especially get out on that little boat and go putter away to the little cafe and drink your seltzers. I would love to do that, but I'm just going to have to come over and visit you to do it, I guess. I'm not here to idealize Reston. I'm here to say, when we imagine what it takes for people to live together in a way that is more integrated, less segregated, that gives us a chance in our lifestyle to work where we live and to spend less time on the road, less time by ourselves, and more time with our family and friends, that kind of vision is achievable, but it takes vision, organization. Letting go of some of the individualized American dream and an embracing of what community can be when we dedicate our best spaces to common space and being together. The vision that John reflects from Revelation is such a space. It's a brilliant, sparkling space, and it requires those who would enter its gates give up, surrender the temptation to the system and powers of domination of that day. And so the challenge for us today is to think what we can do, how we can live in such a way that reflects God's sacred light in our world, in our places that we live and work. What can we do? What does it mean to be a disciple of Jesus in the places that we live? In Scripture, the image of the city is that image of the places where humans dwell. What does it mean to dwell in the city as though we were dwelling in a sacred place? As though the light of the divine were shining through us, lighting our way, healing the nations, bringing us together. Author Michael Frost suggests 5 practices for those who dwell in the city. I'll share them with you. If you like to take notes, this is a good place to take notes, 1 through 5. Number 1, bless. Seek to do at least one act of blessing each day, either to a brother or sister in the Lord or to someone outside the community of faith. Oh, maybe one a day to each group would even be better. There's a wide range of choices for this sort of thing. Anything from a simple encouraging note or remark to a gift to some sort of service. Bless. Number 2, eat. Can you do that? Eat. Eat at least one meal per week with others. And alternate between those inside the community of faith and those outside the community of faith. That might be a challenge. Good things happen around the table. Our lives change when we spend time breaking bread with others. Number 2 is eat. Number 3, listen. Devote at least a few minutes each day listening to the promptings of the Holy Spirit. This could be during a prayer walk, or it could be spending time in solitude with God. Number 3 is listen. Number four, learn. Read from the Gospels or at least for at least a few minutes each day to stay Jesus-centered. Also, each week, read from the other books of the Bible as well as some other materials, just as long as they're good materials, right? Don't just read what's out there for free or what's just popping up on your little computer screen as you read some other article, because today, as you know, they know how to just give us that little image and that little teaser and saying, you won't believe when you see this, right? It's just going to hook you. Make sure we're making some time to learn and read things that are good, the true food. Number four is learn. The fifth and last, sent. Be alert to the missional opportunities God brings into your life each day. Note the times you cooperate with God as well as the times you resist God. It's okay if you find yourself resisting God. It's a sign God's trying to change you. Ask God to give you eyes to see what God is doing in the people around you so you can join in. Pray for loving boldness, too. Number five is sent. Bless, eat, listen, learn, be sent. From Michael Frost. Friends, following Jesus means bearing the light and love of God, beyond ourselves, beyond these walls, into the city, shaping our life together to reflect the desire of God, that we throw wide the gates to all people, that we dwell together in the holy city, a city of justice and peace. Thanks be to God.